Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzstrom. On today's show, what happens when the FBI uses hacking to obtain evidence? Can that evidence be used against a defendant? What does this mean for the broader debate about how government should employ hacking for law enforcement purposes? What does this mean for the larger debate about government surveillance? Joining me to discuss this is Adam Klein, visiting fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and he is also the International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Adam, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
So there's a particular case that sparked my interest in this issue and why I invited you on the show. In 2015, the FBI took control of a child pornography site called Playpen, and it basically ran the site from a government server in order to kind of find out who was using it. And before we delve into that, can you just explain to our listeners what the Tor browser is? Because I'm guessing most, you know, average internet users don't use the Tor browser, and they often hear the term dark web or the deep web. Can you just explain briefly what that is?
Sure. I should add the caveat that I'm far from a technical expert, although perhaps that will make my explanation more comprehensible to the average user.
Absolutely.
So Tor is a system, it's a browser plugin that you can add to your Firefox browser. And it basically routes your traffic through a series of other servers to the final destination and then back in such a way that the user's IP address is hidden from law enforcement.
So because the internet traffic kind of bounces all over the world.
Correct.
It's difficult. It's not just like when I use a website and they can clearly tell that I'm in Washington, D.C. and probably figure out who I am quite easily. And now, you know, listeners might think that Tor is used for things like child pornography and drug dealing and hiring a hitman. But there are also people who just use it because they're privacy conscious and they don't want the government tracking them.
Sure. So a semi-important fact here is that it was actually the U.S. government that originally financed Tor. And the reason is that you can imagine dissidents in various countries or other people who would have legitimate reasons for wanting to disguise their web traffic. So, of course, this is one of the interesting paradoxes or conundrums in tech policy debates, that so many of the things that can be used for evil can also be used for good.
Yeah, of course. And there are similar, you know, concerns surrounding encryption that, you know, it might be not such a huge deal in the United States if the government has access to our messages. But in other countries, that could get you killed, you
Absolutely.
Know, if you're a journalist in China or Russia. So in the case, the FBI used the server, and how exactly does that work? So, you know, there's this site Playpen, and they figure out that there's this site out there. How exactly do they take control and then use the site to try to find child pornographers?
Sure. So again, I should add the caveat that I'm going to give the very oversimplified description of this.
That's what we want for the podcast.
Just in case there are any engineers out there slamming their foreheads against the table. So basically, the FBI, a foreign law enforcement agency, told the FBI about the site and helped them identify the person who was hosting the site. I believe it was in Naples, Florida. And so the FBI basically went down there and took the servers, copied the site onto its own servers in Newington, Virginia, and this is all in the warrant that was approved in the case, and then basically ran the site for, I believe it was 2 weeks. And anyone who accessed a specific part of the site with the sort of most clearly illegal images hosted on that part was served malware. Now, the details of this are obviously not public, and that's something I think we're going to discuss later in the show. But that malware sent back to the FBI a message telling the FBI the IP address and various other information allowing them to identify the user.
So even though the purpose of using Tor is to avoid that very thing, to avoid your IP address being found out, to avoid your location being found out, that's actually what happened here, is that the FBI was able to get around the main purpose for using Tor and actually find out who was on it. I mean, that's kind of, should that be concerning to people who think that Tor makes them anonymous?
I would note the extraordinary lengths to which the FBI had to go in order to get around Tor, as you put it. They had to effectively steal the site and operate it surreptitiously for 2 weeks. And that's not something that most people trying to identify the users is going to be able to do.
Right. So, and we had a show on cybersecurity myths last week, where one of the main points from that show is just how complicated some of this stuff is and how many months of labor and how real life people on the ground are often needed to pull these things off. So it's not just some FBI guy at his computer casually figuring out who people are. Right. This was a very sophisticated operation.
If I can add one broader point here about cybersecurity generally, it's that the user is always a vulnerability. And no matter how elaborate the cybersecurity precautions are, no matter how sophisticated the encryption that an organization deploys is, a user who clicks the wrong website or opens the wrong file in a suspicious email can introduce malware into the system and can create a vulnerability, no matter how high the walls you've built are.
Right. The human being is always the error-prone entity that can be exploited. You know, you saw that with Stuxnet and all these other complicated things that we talked about in the show before. Now, the big issue that should be concerning to listeners who might not even use Tor or care about Tor is, can the evidence that was obtained be used against a defendant? Now, one of the problems was that judges in Massachusetts and Oklahoma ruled that the warrant was invalid. Can you explain why they ruled that way?
Sure. So this is the principal reason is problem here is the geographic issue. Where is the judge and where is the quote unquote search taking place? Because that's the key thing here for a search warrant. Where is the search taking place? Now, under the current rules, and this for those who are law geeks, is Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. The warrant, the text of the rule seems to say that judges can only issue warrants for searches in their own judicial districts. And there are, I think, 90-some judicial districts in the United States. And so that's a fairly small geographic radius for any individual judge. The problem here is that when the FBI is sending what is presumably a piece of software out onto the computers of unidentified users of this child pornography site, they don't know where those people are. They have no idea where these computers are located. And so several judges have said that based on the text of the current rule, you can't do that. You can't issue a warrant to send malware to users whose locations you don't know and who later turn out to be outside your judicial district. Now, there's a very important thing to add here, which is that this issue is effectively going to go away for future cases. The Rules Committee has changed the rule so that judges will now be able to approve these type of hacking operations, if you want to use that term, without this geographic limitation. And this is just an accommodation to the reality that the government doesn't know where these users are, even if it can clearly knows that they are engaged in some kind of illegal activity. And so this rule will become effective in December unless Congress acts to overturn it.
Right, and that's a major issue that has privacy advocates up in arms, and a lot of the groups that we work with on NSA surveillance, we haven't weighed in on Rule 41 yet, partly because we haven't done our due diligence and really delved into the issue yet, so we don't want to be commenting on something we don't understand. But privacy advocates seem to say that this is going to open the door to all sorts of problems, to government surveillance, that not having that hurdle where judges have to be in the district is going to be a problem. And you have senators like Ron Wyden working around the clock to try to get Congress to undo this change that was actually made by the Supreme Court, if I remember correctly.
So there's a Judicial Rules Committee that recommends rules changes. The Supreme Court then approves them. And then the burden is on Congress to overturn them if they dislike it.
And what would you say to those privacy advocates, to Senator Wyden, about their concerns that this opens the floodgates to all sorts of problems?
Well, I should first say that my organization doesn't take institutional positions and that I don't have a super strong view on this. I understand the concerns. At the same time, this is a recognition of the virtual impossibility of identifying someone's location if they are using very sophisticated software whose principal purpose is to mask their location. And I think many people would feel, as a matter of common sense, that what the FBI did in this case is probably a good thing systemically for the government to be doing, to be identifying the users of sites where they're distributing these very, very terrible images and videos that are being manufactured largely to be disseminated on these sites. And so what is the alternative if the FBI can't do that?
That's a fair point. And so in one of the cases, the issue was the geography. So we've covered that.
Yes.
Basically that you can't know where the computer is, and then you get the warrant and then find out the computer was in a different district where you got the warrant, and now you've just lost the case. But in another case, the judge threw out the evidence that the FBI obtained because the FBI would not reveal the malware to the defense. Now, criminal procedure in general, I'm not a lawyer, so lawyers take this with a grain of salt, but generally we have this notion that when prosecutors find something out relevant to the case, they're supposed to share it with the defense and vice versa, because all, more information leads to a better outcome for both the defendant and the prosecutor, and it's a fairer process. Now, of course, that doesn't always happen, and there's all sorts of cases where prosecutors withhold information or the defense does something shady, but in general, information sharing is the norm. Now, in this case, the defendant wanted to know, well, what was this code that you used to catch me? You know, for whatever reason, the defendant thought that that would help his case. And the FBI said no, and then lost the case. Why did the FBI refuse?
Well, I think we should, if you don't mind, can we sort of zoom out and start at the beginning and explain in very simple terms what the legal rules are?
Yeah, absolutely.
People might be familiar with the basic constitutional rule that you mentioned, which comes from a case called Brady versus Maryland. That's a very famous case in constitutional law. And the basic rule is that if the prosecutors find something or have some evidence that is exculpatory to the defendant, they have to hand it over. Now, in fact, the rules, the criminal rules that we were talking about earlier, go farther than that in the defendant's favor. And so in a criminal prosecution in federal court, the prosecution has to give the defendant anything that might be material to preparing the defense. And so that's much broader. You can imagine a whole range of things that are material to preparing the defense. And so that's the question in these cases. Does the defendant, is it material to his defense to know what the source code contains? Now, the government argues that it's not, because they say, you know, we told you exactly what this program did, and we've showed you the data traffic that went from your computer to our computer, exactly what data we got from your computer, and that should be enough. Now the defense attorneys in these cases that I've seen have, I think, fair argument that they could actually benefit from knowing the source code. They say they might be able to show that the tool actually went further than the warrant allowed it to. But you can imagine all kinds of other arguments that a creative, tricky lawyer might make if they saw the code, right? That, well, this piece of code doesn't accurately, it has flaws in it that might inaccurately report things about what I did, or other objections to the quality of the code. So that's the basic dispute here. As for why the government didn't want to turn over the source code, vulnerabilities are precious. Software vulnerabilities are precious because they can be used for offense like they were in this case, and not just by the FBI, by other government agencies. At the same time, keeping a vulnerability secret creates all kinds of cybersecurity worries, right? If something's not patched, then it can be used by bad guys to steal information or interfere with critical infrastructure in some cases, right? All types of cybersecurity fears that we're concerned about. For this reason, the government has created an internal process called the Vulnerabilities Equities Process that is supposed to bring all of the relevant agencies together to weigh the pros and cons of telling the software manufacturer about the vulnerability versus hoarding it so that the government can use it for things like this, or for foreign intelligence operations or other purposes.
So the basic gist is that we're supposed to weigh the costs and benefits in each case, that we're not going to have a bright line rule one way or the other. We're going to say, okay, in this case, is it more important that the FBI keep their malware secret so that they can use it again and not have to worry about people, you know, this defendant, you know, potentially helping other child pornographers avoid hacking? That seems like the basic concern that seems pretty legitimate. Or is it more important that we uphold his constitutional right to have material items be made or available to his defense? So that's a really tough process.
Well, the constitutional right will be upheld in either case, because if the government doesn't turn it over, they can't use the evidence. So that shows you how much the government apparently values this piece of information, that they're willing to let these cases go. And these are pretty serious cases.
Absolutely.
They're willing to let these cases go rather than turn over the code.
Now, before the show, we wanted to make sure that we talk about what this means for broader debates about cybersecurity, about surveillance. It's not just, I mean, of course, whenever there's an example with child pornography, it's very particular, and there's going to be a lot of emotions on both sides, and it's a very emotionally charged example. But what does this whole issue of the FBI using, you know, malware, kind of using maybe techniques that were traditionally used by the NSA, you know, the FBI becoming more sophisticated, more of a technical body, what does this mean for the things you work on and those issue areas?
Sure. I think one of the most interesting questions is to zoom out a bit and ask ourselves, why is this happening? Because people hear about the government hacking people, and it sounds strange and nefarious, And it seems like it sort of comes out of nowhere, but there's a reason for this. But to understand it, you have to look at the broader debate about technology and privacy that's happening right now. People surely have heard about the iPhone and about encryption increasingly being deployed in communications apps and communications technologies. And now even users who are not technologically sophisticated are benefiting from super strong encryption through common products like the iPhone, like iMessage, and like WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And of course, there are also these powerful tools like Tor that allow you to anonymize your internet behavior. Now, we all know that law enforcement, led by FBI Director Comey, has made a powerful case for a mandate that companies be required to decrypt. I think that's not going to happen in the current political environment, and there are extremely strong arguments going the other way as well.
Well, yeah, there's the basic issue that WhatsApp cannot do end-to-end encryption and then hand over a message. And that's what led to it being shut down in Brazil a couple times, because there are negotiable issues on encryption, things like the FBI Apple case. That was a device security feature that was not end-to-end encryption. That might be negotiable, and we can have serious debates about what government should have access to. But I think, you know, we would argue, and many in the privacy community would say, when it comes to something like end-to-end encryption, unless you mandate that every single person screenshot every WhatsApp message they have and store it for 6 months or a year, like what Iran and Russia are trying to do, you cannot have the notion that only the sender and receiver of a message get something and then have the government also get a copy. And that's, yeah, I think that's why Comey has had some credibility issues on this, because he keeps saying, you know, we need access to end-to-end encryption when that doesn't seem like it's even a possibility.
Well, there are very strong technological but also liberty-based arguments against banning end-to-end encryption, which is what the legislative proposal that Director Comey supports would effectively be.
Right.
Regardless of sort of the merits of those arguments, law enforcement is encountering very real obstacles in its investigations because of these tools, because of these products. And we've spoken to local law enforcement, and they're really in the toughest position, because the FBI can spend $15 million in an exceptional case to get around iPhone encryption. The Peoria Police Department or the San Antonio Police Department can't afford to do that. And so there are piles and piles of these devices piling up. And so there's a real conundrum here for law enforcement. And so the question is, if government can't get this sort of mandatory backdoors that they're asking for, and there are good reasons why they perhaps shouldn't,
right,
what is the answer? And the answer is probably hacking. Getting the data, rather than by intercepting it, getting into the end user's machine and putting yourself effectively in the same position as the end user is. Because that's the point where the data has to effectively come out of cloak and into the clear.
Right. Yeah. And the basic notion that if I'm trying to find out what someone is sending with WhatsApp, the only way I can find out basically is by taking control of their phone.
Exactly. And this is not just, you know, my idiosyncratic view. A group of renowned security researchers published an article called Lawful Hacking in 2014, actually arguing for this as an alternative to mandated backdoors. And the technical reason for that is mandatory backdoors require programmers to effectively add weaknesses into the code.
Yeah, and that makes everyone more vulnerable,
right,
to
exactly.
cyber attacks.
Whereas this takes advantage of existing vulnerabilities and therefore doesn't add additional vulnerability.
And we might really start to see legal hacking become a major talking point in this debate, because it seems like privacy advocates really have held their ground on issues like mandatory backdoors and data retention mandates, and they've been very successful. And the House, the Republican-led House, has a strong civil libertarian streak, you know, with these Tea Party congressmen who are very big on constitutional rights, and then they team up with Democrats, and they are generally able to defeat these types of measures like the Burr-Feinstein bill, which would basically ban encryption. But I think a lot of people are looking for a solution, and they don't want to sacrifice everyone's cybersecurity, and this would be much more targeted. Because if you mandate a backdoor into WhatsApp, that affects a billion people. If you hack one child pornographer, that affects one child pornographer. Now, privacy advocates would say it leads to more surveillance, it has all sorts of other problems that affect other people, but at least, you know, if we think about this as targeted surveillance, it seems more reasonable that the FBI already knows something about this person. They're already been red flagged. It's not mass indiscriminate surveillance, which was at least one of the programs was shut down by the USA Freedom Act. Is legal hacking the future of this debate?
I think that's a very perceptive observation, that this is, given the current political balance of power, this is likely to be the stable end state that we land on, where sort of no one gets everything they want. Everyone gets kind of something that they want. It's not a perfect solution. It's not an answer to every problem. But it is a way of giving the government something that they want without crossing red lines for the technology and civil liberties communities. An interesting example, I was in Berlin last week. Germany, which is not a place where mandatory backdoors have been considered at all, has recently created a very large new agency precisely to develop technological tools to break encryption and to perform precisely the kind of targeted hacking operations that we've been talking about for the purpose of assisting law enforcement. And so they seem to have settled on precisely this solution as the sort of stable policy end state, at least for the time being, and the sort of encryption and privacy debate.
Now, you mentioned that you're working on a project on this. Are there certain best practices that you could, that you might recommend to that type of, that agency you mentioned in Germany or others, to avoid some of the concerns that, or at least to address some of the concerns that privacy advocates have? I mean, you could imagine, you know, if the FBI is engaging in all sorts of hacking to break encryption, that could, you could argue that undermines encryption, that if those tools are then hacked themselves, you know, if the FBI has a bad apple in the bunch who then reveals all this malware to every child pornographer out there so that they can fight back. I mean, clearly these are powerful tools. They're dangerous tools in the wrong hands. We need to be careful about where they go. So if legal hacking is the answer because of politics, because of technology, for a variety of reasons, are there certain things that you might recommend that could make this work better and to not have another blow up over Apple FBI, to have some level of consensus on this issue?
Well, I should add that I don't think it's a panacea. I think that in a world where there's not the political will to create the kind of sort of mandatory backdoors or mandatory decryption requirement that the FBI has been seeking, then it's a sort of middle ground where the FBI can still get, and the government can still get, some tools to address these very serious law enforcement problems. That said, I think it's we're too early into this debate to have best practices. And I think we need more data, frankly. This is a good reason for Congress to hold hearings and look at this seriously. And I think we need transparency, frankly, to inform the public debate. So how often is this being done? What types of tools are they using technologically? For what type of crimes is this being used? What agencies are doing this? Is it just the FBI or other agencies involved? What's the oversight process internally? How often is it in response to encryption? Or so what are the technological obstacles that are prompting this? Are they exploiting vulnerability? What types of software are they exploiting? When are the vulnerabilities disclosed, if at all, right? How often are the vulnerabilities involved in lawful hacking being disclosed at the end, or how often are they being retained? And this can't just be a drip, 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 case by case as these things come out in court documents. We need some kind of sort of overarching mechanism to provide useful consolidated data that policy advocates and Congress can use to come up with a reasonable overarching set of guidelines for this.
Yeah, transparency is always a major issue. And, you know, whatever your thoughts are on Edward Snowden, people, very polarizing figure, but I think most people recognize that he led to a debate. That what he did, basically, if you disagree with it, whatever, the information he revealed led to a major public debate about surveillance, which we might not otherwise have had. And due to the nature of this issue, it seems incumbent on entities like the FBI, like the NSA, private firms, to put more information out there about hacking so that people can have an informed debate. And that might, the lack of information might be one of the reasons why we have such a blow up over Rule 41 and why it gets so heated so quickly, because people are rightfully skeptical of what the government says and they don't have much information to go on.
I think that's the democratic accountability point is an important one. The public obviously can't know the specific details of every operation, but it's important that it have a sense of the general contours of what powers the government is claiming. I think the Section 215 telephone call records program that was perhaps the highest profile Snowden revelation is a good example of this. The statute allowed the government to get records relevant to a terrorism investigation, but the secret court opinion that the government had obtained deemed all telephone records by major carriers relevant to a terrorism investigation. And I don't think anyone could have concluded from that statute, that the public text of that statute, that that's what was going on.
Yeah, and that's why.
And that gap between what the public believed and what was actually happening was the reason why it was such a major blow up. And I think it's just a best practice in the post-Snowden era, even and especially, and perhaps especially for practices that are that would widely be seen as legitimate, which I think this one would be, for the government to forthrightly explain what it believes the law authorizes and to give people a general sense of what is going on.
Absolutely. I think more sunshine, more information is generally a good practice in complicated issues like this. And we'll certainly be tracking this debate as it gets more relevant and as legal hacking becomes a bigger talking point in the debate about surveillance. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Adam Klein, visiting fellow at the Center for a New American Security and International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Adam, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks a lot.
Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show at media@techfreedom.org. Send us an email. Let us know what you want to hear, topics you like, topics you don't like, guests you like, guests you don't like, hosts that you don't like. If you want me to be replaced, let me know. Find this podcast in the iTunes store where you can leave us a review because that will help others find the show. And thanks for listening. Don't get hacked.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.